matter of the estate of Michael B. Jones. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning.
I'm sorry, could you just pronounce your last name again?
Yeah.
Thank you. Good morning, counsel, and welcome, Mr. Wheelahan. Please come to the center. Thanks.
May it please the court. May I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
Necessary.
We may have you back for a little less, but yes.
That's fine, Your Honor. Thank you. This case involves the interpretation of a divorce settlement agreement, or DSA, between the decedent Michael Jones and his former spouse, Janine Jones. It also involves the interpretation and application of federal regulations regarding U.S. savings bonds in the context of a divorce where the husband fails to remove his ex-spouse as the pay-on-death beneficiary of those bonds. Finally, this matter involves whether New Jersey law, including NJSA 3B:3-14, is preempted by the applicable federal regulations. As to the interpretation of the DSA, it is the estate's position that the appellate division erroneously concluded that the terms of the DSA did not encompass Michael's savings bonds. Under the language of the DSA, specifically Section 1, which addresses equitable distribution, the parties set forth that the DSA is specifically intended to outline the transfers, conveyances, and assignments necessary to effectuate equitable distribution. Section 1 also contains a very broad catch-all provision specifically designed to capture property and assets not otherwise set forth in the DSA. That provision provides any marital asset not listed in the DSA belongs to the party who has it currently in their possession. There is a second broad catch-all in the agreement, which states that husband, Michael, shall have exclusive use, possession, and ownership of all items titled in his name solely, including cash on hand, cash in the bank, all personal effects, etc., currently in his possession. In addition, Section 2 of the divorce settlement agreement, under the caption separate property, provides, except as otherwise provided herein, the parties agree that whatever property he or she now owns or may hereafter have or acquire in his or her respective name shall henceforth be considered his or her sole and separate property, with the proviso that any late or later discovered or undisclosed assets shall be within the jurisdiction of the family court. In this particular case, Michael, it is clear, owned the bonds solely in his own name. He began purchasing them shortly before the parties were married. They were always titled in his name alone. And his wife, Janine, was the pay-on-death beneficiary. So, Your Honors, the estate's position is that the language and the intent of the parties under the DSA is that these bonds, although not specifically listed in the DSA, would be distributed in accordance with those multiple provisions that I've just recited to the court. There are multiple provisions, the outcome of which is the same. The person who possesses that property at the time of the execution of the DSA will be the sole owner of that property. There is no dispute, and Janine makes it clear in her deposition testimony, she was aware of these bonds the entire time. She never contested Michael's ownership of the bonds following the execution of the DSA or during the period following the divorce up until Michael's death. It was only after Michael's death that Janine then went, gained possession of the bonds, and redeemed them.
So let's start with the bonds themselves. Before Michael died, who owned the bonds?
Michael.
And who owned them when he died, according to the power of death beneficiary designation?
The pay on death beneficiary was Janine. And Your Honor,
don't they automatically belong to Janine then?
Just the estate recognizes that a federal regulation, section 353.20, does, I'm sorry, yes, 3.570, forgive me, does, it's 70, 3.353.70C1, does in fact state that upon the death of the owner, the pay on death beneficiary does become the absolute owner.
Doesn't that designation answer the question though?
It does not, Judge, Your Honor. And here's why. Because under the terms of this DSA, even if Janine became the absolute owner, she was contractually bound to accept those bonds as either payment of any remaining balance due and owed to her under the DSA, or she was contractually obligated to turn them back over to the estate.
So put the DSA to one side for just a moment. Is there any authority that the POD designation loses its force that you can point us to?
Certainly, Your Honor. New Jersey state law first, NJSA 3B:3-14, which has an automatic revocation provision, which is designed for these particular circumstances.
So let's look at the statute and see what it says. Except as provided by the express terms of a governing instrument, a divorce or annulment revokes any revocable disposition made by a divorced individual to his former spouse in a governing document. Two questions. Is the designation of ownership listed on the bond revocable? And if so, what's the authority to revoke what appears on the bond itself?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, there is authority to revoke the pay on death designation under the federal regulations. Specifically, section 353.20 permits a bond owner, particularly in the context of a divorce, to present the divorce decree, which incorporates the settlement agreement, to Treasury, and Treasury may reissue. And that brings us, you know, to the next point.
But he didn't do that.
He did not do that. That is correct. And under the Sveen versus Mellon decision, the United States Supreme Court decision, in that case, Justice Kagan recognizes that this happens regularly and is very common. And as the appellate division observed, the bond is a contract. It's a contract between the purchaser, Michael, and the United States government. And in the Sveen decision, the court determined in the context of an insurance policy, which incidentally was not specifically mentioned in the divorce settlement agreement in that case, the court recognized that in that instance, a Minnesota statute, which is very similar to the New Jersey statute here, there is a presumption, and it's a rebuttable presumption, that a divorcee would not want his or her ex-spouse to benefit after a divorce. So in that...
But Sveen didn't actually consider a bond to which the United States was a party, correct?
I'm sorry.
Sveen, the Supreme Court case that we're discussing right now, didn't actually consider a bond to which the U.S. was a party, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So none of the federal bond regulations that you were previously discussing could be relevant to Sveen because Sveen just wasn't about a federal bond.
Well, I would submit to Your Honor that, again, because the bonds are deemed or interpreted as contracts and the regulations are incorporated therein, the analysis under Sveen, which the estate contends should be applied in the context of savings bonds, is that the application of NJSA 3B:3-14 is not violative of the contracts clause under the United States Constitution.
But it's not the contracts clause that's at issue with bonds, right? Isn't it the fact that the United States Supreme Court has said that federal bonds must be enforced in accordance with federal law because it's a contract with the federal government?
That is correct, Your Honor. Even if we put the preemption issue aside, however, again, if I know Your Honor wanted to move away from the divorce settlement agreement, but if we got back to the divorce settlement agreement, back to my point earlier, even if the federal regulations say that those the proceeds from those bonds go directly to Janine, contractually, she was obligated either to accept those funds as payment for any unpaid balance due under the $200,000.
But why was she obligated to accept that? Let me ask you a hypothetical. So what if Michael lived through 2020 and all payments were made to Janine in the amount of the $200,000? All the payments were satisfied. Michael passes in 2021. What happens to the bonds?
Well, if we look at how the appellate division interpret the agreement, theoretically, Janine could still go after Michael. And that's
go after Michael, meaning she's 2021, estate. She's still the pay on death beneficiary.
And therefore, that's correct.
The bonds still pay to her. And in that scenario, there's no amount due on the $200,000. So either way, she's still the pay on death beneficiary. So it wouldn't matter if there was an amount owed to her on that $200,000 or not in that scenario.
If we accept the appellate division's interpretation of the DSA, and Your Honor, what I'm saying is that under the terms of the DSA, it was clear that the bargain here, the contract here, was that wife, Janine, gets $200,000. She waived her right to inherit to the extent, with the exception that if amounts were still due and owing, then the remainder of the $200,000 would be paid to her from Michael's estate.
So this takes me back to the statute you're relying on, 3B:3-14. Is it clear in the DSA that it is revoking this disposition of the bonds because it doesn't mention the bonds at all?
It does not, Your Honor, specifically mention the bonds. However, given those very specific catch-all phrases and the language and the circumstances.
But the catch-all that you mentioned in Section 1 with regard to all assets currently in their possession, belong to the party who has it currently in their possession. Currently in their possession would mean, with regard to the bonds, while Michael was still alive, right? He was the owner of those bonds that was currently in his possession. But at the moment of his death, those bonds were no longer in his possession, and Janine was the pay on death. So I'm not sure how the catch-alls that you're referring to in the DSA help you, because the currently in their possession language falls away the moment Michael passes. I mean, isn't that correct? You agree that she's the pay on.
I agree that she's the pay on death benefit.
So what happens again at the moment Michael passes with regard to the bonds?
The estate's position is that the moment that happens, we take a look and see if there's an unpaid balance. If there's an unpaid balance, then Janine gets those bonds to make up the difference.
And again,
Janine
does not get
a bonus.
And again, if there was no unpaid balance.
Oh, there was an unpaid
balance. I know there was. I'm asking you if there was no unpaid balance.
My argument would be, again, that it would be a misreading of the divorce settlement agreement and, frankly, an inequitable result to say that Janine would get a bonus on top of what she already received.
So the unpaid balance, your position is the unpaid. It sounds like your position is the unpaid balance doesn't really matter. Either way, the estate's position is she doesn't get the bonds.
That was certainly not my intent, Your Honor, if that's what I conveyed. The estate and the trial court agreed that she got the bonds. Okay, that counts towards the $200,000 that she was supposed to be paid. And that's the estate's position.
How do you reconcile your position with the CFR regulation 353-5A? In this case, the registration on the bonds is clear. They're Michael's before he dies. And then there's the POD beneficiary designation. The CFR reg says registration is conclusive of ownership. Are we being faithful to that with the argument that you're advancing?
Under the Smalley versus Smalley, the Texas appellate court decision that I cited, as well as Mirror versus Garvey, the Florida appellate decision that I cited, the answer is yes, there is no conflict because, again, contractually, even if we say that Janine was the conclusive owner as of the time of Michael's death, very good. Then, once again, that amount goes towards the either unpaid balance or she's contractually obligated to give it back to the estate.
So where do we see that in the DSA? Where in the DSA does it say anything about Janine being contractually obligated to give anything back to anyone?
Your Honor, it does not specifically state that.
Or it doesn't. And where in the DSA does it say Janine shall get $200,000 and no more than $200,000? And if she ever comes into possession of any more than $200,000, she shall be contractually obligated to hand it over.
Again, Your Honor, it doesn't specifically state that, but let's just take a look at the provisions, particularly regarding the house. So Michael was, under the DSA, awarded the home, but the parties agree that in the event Michael were to sell the home, and at that time there was an unpaid balance under the terms of the DSA, then Michael would be obligated to immediately pay Janine the balance due.
But that provision, like everything else in the DSA, is entirely under the control of the two parties to this divorce. There isn't the house is sold, the proceeds are divided. What we're talking about here is an asset as to which the federal government is the other party in the contract. There's either a contract with Michael, or after his death as POD, there's a contract with Janine to pay the value of the bonds. So if the DSA is silent as to an asset that is the subject of a contract with the federal government, how can we presume that that the disposition of that asset is somehow inferred in the provisions that deal with the parties' respective obligations? See what I'm saying? There is a different party there.
Understood, Your Honor. But again, the application of the divorce settlement agreement, as well as New Jersey law, would not interfere with the contract with Michael and the United States. And it would not interfere with the United States payment of the bond funds directly to Janine. It would not interrupt that scenario. What the estate is arguing and what the trial court agreed with is that, fine, the federal regulations took their process.
Should be an offset.
But there should be an offset.
But that is so easily drafted into that, if that were the intent of the parties. It's something that, without affecting what the feds do, he would either say, I will not revoke that POD, or he would say, if the opposite was their intent, he would say Michael will change the POD to his daughter, whatever it might be, and take steps to do that. But it is completely silent as to something that that one would think, if there were intent, it would be written in that document.
Understood, Your Honor. But if I may, a couple points to make about that. First and foremost, the parties drafted this agreement themselves. They did the best they could. They were initially represented by counsel. They disengaged their counsel, and they, in her testimony, went to a divorce center and got this form and cobbled it together. That's number one. Number two, in the event that we are questioning what was the real intent, should we not remand that? Should the appellate division have not remanded that, then, that question back to the family court or the trial level to determine what was the intent? What was the intent under a reasonable and practical reading of this DSA that these pro se parties drafted?
Let's go back to your first point for a second. You pointed us to a specific clause with respect to the home that covered different contingencies. They didn't do that with the bonds. We can tell from the DSA that, however they put this together, they had a sense of areas where they wanted to be specific. How can we read that specific intent into other sections?
May I offer you this provision, Your Honor, to address that? Section 1, equitable distribution. The parties agree that should husband predecease wife, the proceed from husband's estate will compensate the wife for the remainder of the $200,000 in the event there is an unpaid balance. That's why, Your Honors, I believe that this agreement should be read as a whole and should be read reasonably and practically to, you know, set forth the bargain that was made here was $200,000. The bonds were basically, you know, collateral. The other assets that weren't specifically identified were essentially collateral. And I say that because of this particular provision. Janine agrees here. I waive my right to inherit. Now, I know the agreement is inconsistent because there are other more general clauses that the appellate division relied on, but this particular phrase, this particular clause says, if Michael dies and there's an unpaid balance, Janine may proceed against Michael's estate for the unpaid balance, not unpaid balance plus whatever else.
Well, that doesn't beg the question, though, because the question is what is the unpaid balance and what assets should be considered in that?
Your Honor raises a good point. It's the estate's position that certainly the bonds were included because I know that there is, you know, the argument from Janine that the bonds were not really in Michael's estate. And as I pointed out to the court in my supplemental brief, I would say for tax purposes, au contraire, they would be considered part of his gross estate for estate tax purposes. And in fact, for New Jersey inheritance tax purposes, because Michael was a resident decedent, even though there's a pay on death designation on those bonds, they don't pass through his probate estate. But for purposes of inheritance tax, it's a transfer from Michael, a resident decedent, to Janine, who at Michael's death.
A pre-death transfer is treated for tax purposes, right?
Well, even when there's a pay on death, Your Honor, the that's going
to
be
it's
viewed.
Isn't it treated similarly to a situation where someone gives gives stocks to a grandchild or a child pre-death, wouldn't that be treated, wouldn't the bonds be treated the same way for tax purposes? They're not part
when
of the
When you say pre-death, then we would...
Not in the will, but prior to death.
Prior to death, if they're given, then we would take a look at the circumstances. We would say, okay, this was a gift. And depending on how much later in time the decedent passes away, we would have to look at whether those assets get clawed back into the estate.
But you would not be clawed. Could you ever claw back these bonds as part of an estate and just dispose of them as part of his estate, regardless of who was the POD?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't understand.
Would you ever be able to claw back the bonds and treat them as if they were cash that should be considered part of the estate?
I believe under New Jersey inheritance tax law, you could.
Can you clarify the point you were just making? What's the tax burden on the estate in this circumstance once it was a pay on death?
Excellent question. Because there was no will, the death taxes would be apportioned between the taxable beneficiaries. It is, in fact, ultimately the administrator's burden to make sure that tax gets paid. The administrator theoretically could then, seek reimbursement from the non-Class A beneficiary who received the proceeds. So perhaps that's a long-winded answer to your question, but the estate is responsible to pay the taxes with the ability to perhaps pursue the transferee.
Can we take a look at, go back to the statute, the New Jersey statute for a moment. So 3B:3-14 begins with the phrase, except as provided by the express terms of the governing instrument, and then indicates what we've been discussing about with regard to property of divorced individuals. What is your response to respondents' argument that the terms of the federal bonds that require the bond to be paid on death to the pay on death beneficiary falls within this introductory clause that accepts the express terms of a governing instrument?
At the risk of repeating myself, Your Honor, I will. My response to that is, once again, even if we were to view that provision as saying Janine became the absolute owner, the DSA still contractually...
The DSA that doesn't say anything about the bonds. The DSA that doesn't say anything about the governing instrument that is referred to.
I concede that point, Your Honor. It does not specifically state, but again, based on the arguments that I've made, it's the estate's position that this was broad enough. And again, if there is a question as to the applicability of these broad catch-all provisions and what the parties were really thinking at the time, I submit to the court that that's a matter for remand to the trial court to figure out.
Is this a fair summary that your reading of the DSA is that it effectively wipes clean the POD beneficiary?
In the circumstances of this case, the practical outcome is yes, because we the estate is saying that the $77,864.40 that Janine received by redeeming those bonds should be credited towards the amount that Michael owed under the terms of the DSA.
Is your more general argument that pursuant to the DSA, Janine is entitled to $200,000 and $200,000 only, no matter how she gets to that number?
Correct, Your Honor.
What other assets besides the bonds were not mentioned in the DSA? Marital assets.
There were two vehicles. There were some bank accounts, relatively small balances. There was mention of 401ks and pension plans and that sort of thing. They weren't specifically identified, but there were those other assets.
Well, were there any other assets besides the bonds that were not, that were available but not mentioned in the DSA?
Yes.
Because the cars are mentioned, the checking accounts mentioned. I think everything that you just said is mentioned in here. So
you're right. I'm not sure.
I think this is Dave Patterson was asking: were there any other assets outside of the bonds that weren't mentioned in the DSA? That's what we're trying to understand.
No, you're wrong.
Leaving aside the bonds, they, despite the fact that at the time they were not represented by counsel when this was finalized, they successfully listed all of their marital assets and disposed of them in the DSA.
For the most part, yes, Judge.
Well, is it for the most part?
What's
or
missing?
Is it?
Yes, Your Honor, they did. I would say, you know, the personal effects and the household furnishings, but you know, the house was dispersed to Michael under the terms of the DSA. The house was furnished. There were items in there that theoretically could have been levied against or, you know, sold to pay off the balance.
But you would probably infer the intent that the furniture goes with the house.
Agreed, Your Honor.
There's really nothing. There's nothing out there. There's not an investment property or anything out there that didn't end up in that.
That's correct.
Your Honor. Agreement.
If we were to find that the express terms of the DSA do not encompass the bonds, does the statute that you've relied on still apply?
Yes, because the statute 3B:3-14 is really, it steps in. It's a default where items are not specifically mentioned in a governing instrument here, the divorce settlement agreement or the judgment of divorce. That's where 3B:3-14 steps in and has the presumption of revocation. Again, a presumption that can be rebutted, but it's presumed that if the assets, particularly non-probate assets, are not specifically mentioned, then that's when this statute kicks in. So it is, quite frankly, designed to be a gap filler, particularly in cases like this, where parties leave things out of the divorce settlement agreement.
But the statute does begin by stating, except as provided by the terms of the governing instrument.
Understood, Your Honor, but there's nothing in the DSA that says the pay on death beneficiary shall remain Janine. It was an oversight. It was, if at worst, it was an oversight. But again, I'm saying that it was actually covered by the broad language.
But the federal regulations don't provide this same type of gap filler presumption in any circumstance, correct?
That is correct. And that's why the estate argues there's not a conflict, because the federal regulations do not address this issue. So the estate's position is there's room for New Jersey state law to step in.
So let's probe that a little bit, because I know that in your briefing, you talked a lot about 31 CFR 353.22, but 353.15 says savings bonds are not transferable and are payable only to the owners named on the bonds, except as specifically provided in these regulations, and then only in the matter and to the extent so provided. And then 353.20B explains how Treasury will recognize a claim against an owner of the bonds if established by valid judicial proceedings specifically listed in this part. And then 353.23A says to establish the validity of a judicial proceeding, certified copies of the final judgment, decree, or court order must be submitted. So as the Chief Justice pointed out before, the federal regulations say whoever is the named owner is the owner. And that is conclusive of ownership, and Treasury will only recognize a claim of someone else if it's established by a valid judicial proceeding. And the way to get that recognized is to mail in these copies of the proceeding. And none of that ever happened here. So presumably under the federal regulations, Janine remains the recognized owner because she is the POD beneficiary, and nothing was ever done to change that.
Agreed, Your Honor. But the federal regulations and even the Free versus Bland decision states that the bonds themselves are not immunized from claims. In this instance, the claim against the bonds, if you will, is made by the estate. And the estate is saying, you got those bonds. The estate recognizes that Michael was contractually obligated to pay a certain amount, but you've received those bonds, therefore the estate should get a credit. That's essentially the claim that the estate is making. And that's not making an end run around the federal regulations. That's essentially making a claim against those bonds. We're saying those bonds should be applied to the unpaid balance. So there's no conflict because, again, the bonds are not immunized.
Regardless, I'm not sure that I understood that. Under the federal regulations, it makes it seem like the person whose name is on the bond owns the bond unless something affirmative is done to change that. And the Treasury is extremely specific with what those affirmative things are that can be done. It doesn't say, for example, that a state statute can come in and change it automatically by a default rule. And it doesn't say, for example, that an estate can come in by after the fact saying, we think this is unfair. We don't think that this comports with the intent of the parties. It is very specific, as sometimes federal regulations are, in detailing exactly what you have to submit and what it has to look like. And none of that happened here. So I'm just not sure when you say you have a claim against the estate, how is that comporting? I'm sorry, when you say the estate has a claim against the bond, the Treasury says you can only have a claim against the bond if you establish it by a valid judicial proceeding, and that in order to do that, you have to send in certified copies of certain things, and none of that happened.
Agreed, Your Honor. Procedurally, the paperwork was not filed. I have to concede that point.
I take you back to the statute. Do you have it in front of you?
The New Jersey
3B3-14. Yes. We've covered it already. There's the introductory language that Justice Pierre-Louis read recently. But then there is a second reference to governing instrument that I hope you can explain its import. It says, if we move down, a divorce or annulment revokes any revocable disposition made by a divorced individual to his former spouse in a governing instrument. What's the meaning of that? And does this governing instrument revoke the bonds? If it doesn't, how does this gap filler apply?
Thank you, Your Honor. The governing instrument in this particular case is the pay on death designation on the bond. It is also in the context of a divorce, the divorce settlement agreement and the final judgment of divorce.
So your position is the governing instrument is not the DSA, it's the savings bond.
Well, a governing instrument is also something that the decedent executed, signed off on prior to his death. So the governing instrument could also be a judicial order that basically incorporates.
Could be what? I'm sorry?
A judicial order, a judgment of.
Is it in this case? What's the governing interest? Instrument, excuse me.
The governing instrument is the divorce settlement agreement. But
and the savings bond
it is the pay on death designation, because if even getting back to the Sveen decision, the beneficiary designation on the insurance policy, the insurance policy itself and that beneficiary designation, that is something executed, signed by the contracting party, by the policy owner. And that is considered part and parcel of governing instruments for purposes of the statute.
Section B2 states, governing instrument means a governing instrument executed by the divorced individual before the divorce or annulment.
Correct.
Isn't that the DSA and not the savings bond?
Yes.
But then 3B1 colon or 1-1 says a governing instrument is a deed, will, trust, insurance, or annuity policy or account with the designation pay on death. So you're saying that the POD itself is the governing instrument under 3B colon 1-1?
The way that this statute is written, I think we have to look at both of those things.
So it's the DSA and the POD?
Yes.
But if it's the DSA, again, does not specifically say anything about the bonds.
Correct.
Right. So section,
not specific.
Section A1A, when it discusses dispositions or appointments of property made by a divorced individual to his former spouse in a governing instrument, there is no disposition of property or anything made to the former spouse in the DSA.
Correct.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate the time.
Confusion.
Thank you for hearing the case this morning, Your Honors. I know it has some complicated issues, but I think the court is familiar with the issues, and I rely on the brief I submitted, but I'd be happy to answer any questions the court has. Otherwise, I would rest on what I've written in the brief. So unless the court has questions.
Why don't you speak to the import of the state statute 3B colon 3-14? Tell us your view of it.
I guess my view is I would start with the kind of a fundamental premise, which is to try to construe the statute in a way where it avoids any kind of a constitutional infirmity. And that's why I tried to focus on the first, you know, that kind of predecessor clause, except as provided by the express terms of a governing instrument. But I understand what Your Honor is saying is the governing instrument in this particular situation, the Series E bond, or is it the DSA?
But what's your answer to that?
I think in that part of the clause, I think governing instrument based on the definitions is the bond. And my argument there to avoid any constitutional infirmity is to say, well, the express terms of the bond or the federal regulations and federal law makes it clear that those are incorporated into the bond.
But doesn't the DSA mm-hmm. also meet the definition of a governing instrument?
It does, and it makes the statute.
Does that different. Mean you have the battle of the governing instruments?
Yeah, it makes it very difficult to kind of say how the statute applies.
Has any court in the past ever held that a bond or a set of bond regulations were a governing instrument?
Not in this state, and no state that I've seen. I guess from a kind of a stepping back standpoint, I understand that there are some questions about how the statute actually applies. I guess my fundamental premise would be try to construe the statute in this particular case as applied here in a way so that it doesn't run counter to the federal law. And I would say that the federal law is the supreme law, and it's most particularly supreme here because, as the court has noted, the government is actually a contract.
You're not pressing preemption at this point?
I think the court should probably try to avoid that issue if it can.
You might like to, but if it's in the case.
Yeah, I mean, if it has to move, if it says the statute applies in this case to revoke Janine's beneficiary status, okay, or her. So I think the problem really is timing.
Tell me if I'm wrong, she was the one who initially brought up preemption. Was she not?
In the lower court?
Yeah.
I think she was the one who raised the issue of the federal statute.
But she's now not saying it's, and of course the appellate division found.
Right.
So she is, just to be clear as to her position, she's not pressing a preemption argument?
I guess the way, and this was only an argument I really made before this court, I didn't see anyone make the argument that focused on the except as provided by the express terms. But when I look at it in terms of a legal problem, again, I would think that the court should attempt to construe the statute in a way so it avoids any issue of preemption.
No, I understand. I understand that argument. Okay. There, a preemption argument, if it is made, mm-hmm. says that mm-hmm. the state statute mm-hmm. should be utterly ignored because it is preempted by the federal regulations.
In this case, right.
That was in this case.
That's the secondary argument I make. Right.
So what's the status of that argument as a position taken by Janine at this
point? No, I mean, I put that in the brief as the second point. If the court believes that in this case, the statute operates to revoke or deprive Janine essentially of the $77,000, the statute is invalid as applied in this case, because it runs counter to the federal law.
So how do you respond to the estate's argument that you can accept federal law as it is, that Janine owned the bonds, and you can accept the state law, or you don't even have to listen to the state law, you can just say Janine owns the bonds. But either way, the DSA says she's entitled to $200,000 and $200,000 only, and not 1 cent over $200,000. So even if she owns the bonds, that counts towards the $200,000. And if she had already gotten the $200,000, she'd have to give it back to the estate. How do you respond to that?
I would say the DSA, first of all, there was no finding that the DSA says that, and it clearly doesn't say that. There's no provision in the DSA that says anything like that. It doesn't mention the bonds. And beyond that, there was no finding below, and there's really no evidence at all about the bonds or about what Michael intended to do with the bonds.
Regardless of the bonds, I think the estate's point is the DSA says she's entitled to $200,000 mm-hmm. and $200,000 only.
Right.
How do you respond to that?
Well, I think the problem with that is, it is an end run, with all due respect to my adversary, around how the federal law works. Because the way I look at the federal law is, the minute he died, she immediately became owner of the bonds. If you say, oh, she's only entitled to $200,000, and you essentially deduct the amount she got from the bonds, that deprives her right as an owner under the bonds under federal law. And
why? Can't you contract that even with assets that you own, you are required to do something with them, to give them to someone else to?
Yeah, you could, Your Honor. And indeed, as you mentioned, I think during the argument of my adversary, the federal regulations provide for that. They talk about a divorce decree and valid judicial proceedings. I think the main problem in this case is the timing. If that had occurred during the divorce proceedings or even shortly thereafter while Michael still owned it, okay, the federal regulations provide that you can submit it and say, oh, this has been changed. Even ownership could have been changed in that regard. I think the biggest problem in this case is that once Michael died, the federal law prescribes exactly who becomes the owner of the bond, and the state court can't come in and change that federal created right. Most particularly in a case where the United States government is not only a contractual party, but indeed it's borrowing from its constitutional power, Congress's power to borrow money. I think it's very problematic to say that a state court can come in and change those federal constitutional rights. And I do think it is an end run around the federal right. It's form over substance. If you essentially say, well, yeah, you own the bonds, but now we're going to take this other $77,000 out of your other pocket, that impairs the federal right.
But I think the estate's point is, no, it doesn't, because you could have a contract that says, if you come into money at some point in the future, you must turn it over to the estate because you're only entitled to $200,000 or something like that.
I mean, that could be a question for another day, Your Honor. I know there are other scenarios that are always difficult to envision. But in this case, I really, you know, with all due respect, I just don't see, even if you say, well, we can't construe this New Jersey statute in a way to avoid the conflict, there's no, the best authority for preemption is what did the federal court say? And in fact, the United States Supreme Court, I mean, that Free and that Yachos case, they're almost on all fours. It's very difficult to say the state law, any state law, can come in and change rights under this governmental contract. It's
Just to follow up on Justice Wiener-Raptor's mm-hmm. question, it's possible that there could have been an express provision in the DSA that suggested that should any other POD provisions come into existence at a later point, that those will be brought back to the estate, however it's done. What's your position on on counsel's argument that the DSA, in the spirit of it, does include the bond.
I mean, no court found that below, and no fair reading of the language in the DSA even suggests it. The bonds aren't even mentioned.
What about the two catch-all phrases that Mr. Relihan points us to?
But even the catch-all phrases, all the catch-all phrases say, except if Michael's paid, they're contingent on him paying her the $200,000. So even those catch-all phrases don't really seem to come.
Doesn't that make it seem like it's $200,000 only, regardless of how you get
there? I mean, I guess you could try to read the DSA in a way that says that. But again, one, I don't think that a legal construction of the DSA provides for that. And beyond that, the federal regulations talk about, well, how can you put into effect what a DSA may provide? So even if we assume it says what my adversary says it says, okay, and we just take his position, the DSA contractually obligated Janine to, I guess, give up her beneficiary status, essentially, okay? They didn't follow the federal regulations, which are very detailed, as Your Honor mentioned, about how you have to recognize that. It has to be by a divorce decree. So I think one of the problems is the timing. It's too late. Like, we're in a civil lawsuit at this point, and they're basically trying to take back an owner's right under federally created bonds. That's very problematic. Especially, this isn't even, my adversary talks about field preemption and all. This is actually at the top of preemption because the United States government is a contracting party to the bonds. And anything that could impair its rights to borrow is totally invalid. So I don't really see how we get around and say that the state law can possibly be effective in
this
situation.
The borrowing has already happened. I mean, if you're relying entirely on impairment of the federal right to borrow, I suppose there might be an argument that says if you force someone who buys a bond to give up or give up what they really wanted with respect to the POV, that might be an issue. But the borrowing's already occurred. Michael bought the bonds.
Yeah.
If he's deceased, how is the federal right to borrow impaired if a New Jersey state court makes a determination?
Well, because the whole concept of buying a bond, right, as I understand it, at least, is to provide that kind of concrete security. And that's how the government is able to borrow money, at least in the venue of bonds. The way I understand it is that if the state court, in other words, if you have a right to redeem the bonds as the owner, and that right is infringed in any way, which in this case it would be because, yeah, Janine got $77,000 from the bonds, but then it was taken out of her other pocket. So essentially she got.
How does that affect the owner of the bonds, the buyer, the lender in this
government
transaction was Michael.
But it affects. I'm sorry, Your Honor. It affects the Congress's power to borrow money, because if you dilute that security that the United States Savings Bond is supposed to give concrete assurances.
But it's not by saying that security, because let's say the bond was purchased. It was a $50 bond and it's going to pay out as $100 in however many years. It did do that.
But the registered owner of the bond didn't get the money.
But that
is what's going to happen.
Even if she did, I think the estate is saying she did get the money, but then she had to turn it over to the estate regardless.
That's form over substance.
But you did agree that someone could provide that in a contractual agreement, right?
They
could. That when you receive the bonds, you'll have to do X, Y, or Z in order to turn them over to someone else.
Yes, I think you could, but you'd still have to do it in accordance, I think, with the federal regulations.
Could a New Jersey family judge say, as part of a judgment of divorce, Michael, you have to keep Janine as the POD beneficiary of these bonds?
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the way this is all being done.
Yeah.
Could a New Jersey judge do that without
impairing
the contractual right of
that?
I suspect it happens.
Probably not.
It could. The New Jersey judge could.
I don't think the judge could do that, because under the government contract, under the bonds, which is the United States government and Michael has a right under that contract to change the beneficiary, to sell it. So I don't think the court could.
Family court judge could not say, you're going to leave that as is, Michael, as part of this. This is you're not going to do what the regulations might allow you to.
It would have to be an agreement, I think, between the two
parties. You couldn't have a judge do that as part of a divorce judgment?
I don't think so. Not unless it was in the divorce settlement agreement. And I think the biggest problem in this case is...
Some cases don't get settled. I mean, obviously...
What did you say, Judge? I'm sorry.
Some cases don't get settled.
Some cases don't get settled. But again, I think it's the... this is like... whatever they call it, sui generis. This is a very unique situation because these are bonds. Like a lot of the case law my adversary relies on, it talks about life insurance policies. Well, the United States government has they're not a party to those and they have no interest.
This is the only case in which there's been a dispute over the disposition of bonds after divorce? I suspect it happens a lot.
It probably is covered somewhere. And maybe they cash the bonds in. And I think that's another thing. A lot of the argument is like, this deprived or changed Michael's ownership rights. It didn't at all. I mean, he could have done anything he wanted. But the problem is, once he died, it goes to, well, who's the beneficiary, or it could have been who's a co-owner in certain situations. And at that point, the federal regulations and the law prescribe what has to happen.
Well, your adversary would argue that the federal regulations prescribe that she's the owner. She's the owner. But that reduces the amount that the estate has to provide to her as part of the disposition of the estate.
But how does that not impair the federal created right?
Because the federal regulations are followed. She was POD. She gets the money. The feds are happy. I don't know if the feds are happy, but they're certainly not unhappy about this particular situation. Yeah. See what I'm saying?
Everything
the federal government was trying to accomplish in this transaction is accomplished without any interference with the way the regulations work.
Now, see, that part I don't agree with Your Honor on. Let's say we had a situation where a family court or a state court came in and said, well, we're going to take, in other words, the actual owner of the bonds, who has a right under the contract, they could go back to the government and be like, you paid the wrong person, number one. Okay. There is some federal law that talks about two things. One is it talks about that there's the government, the bonds and the regulations govern who has a right to the payment. Okay. So I do think that impairs the right to borrow from the government, because it makes it less certain. Before, it was governed exclusively by the terms and regulations under the federal law of how the bond works, who's the registered owner. As Your Honor mentioned, the registered owner is conclusive evidence of who's going to get payment. And now you have a state court changing that, and that tends to weaken the security and certainty under the bond. So I do think it impairs the borrowing power of the federal government. But beyond that,
that's not a preemption argument, is it?
Yeah, it is a preemption argument, because I think that you're saying that the state court has a right to essentially interfere with people's contractual expectations under a government contract.
But I mean, are you asserting a constitutional argument that is a preemption argument
It's a preemption argument.
Or state action that is impairing
that is preemption in my view. In this case, it's because it's a contract. It's even more powerful.
So it's a conflict preemption argument?
Yeah, as applied in this case. The statute isn't unconstitutional on its face, because probably 98% of the time it's applied to things that the United States government has nothing to do with, like a life insurance policy or whatever. But in this particular case, the way it's trying to be applied, if Your Honors construe the statute in a way that essentially says, well, you lost out on the $77,000, that conflicts with the way the federal law operates. And there's one other point I guess I would make. There is federal law that talks about, sometimes they call it like an anti-attachment provision, but essentially it says you can't impair somebody's contractual rights under a federally governed contract by making exactly what my adversary suggests here, is an end run around it by saying, well, you technically got the money under the federal contract, but then we took the money away from you in the other pocket. I've seen that referred to as like anti-attachment, but it's a concept under federal law that says the rights under a governmental contract are essentially sacrosanct, and you can't make an end run around them to deprive the person of the ownership. And I think that's what would happen in this case, because the most important thing is this isn't even like a divorce case. It's a civil lawsuit at this point. And you're having a post hoc deprivation of somebody's right to receive that payment. Now, you may have tried to do it in a way that took it out of their other pocket, but the end result is the same. So, unless there's any other questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank you for hearing the case this morning.
Mr. Wheelahan, brief rebuttal?
Very brief. I would just like to point out in response to my adversary's answer to Your Honor's question concerning whether a divorce court could provide for disposition of the bonds, I would just point the court to 31 CFR 353.22, subsection A, the Department of the Treasury will recognize a divorce decree that ratifies or confirms a property settlement agreement disposing of the bonds, or that it otherwise settles the interests of the parties in a bond.
Does this do so?
I'm sorry.
Does this do so without expressly mentioning bonds, this DSA?
Well, I, Your Honor, I was just addressing the Your Honor's hypothetical. Could a divorce court have entered an order saying, Michael, keep Janine as the pay on death beneficiary? I submit to the court based on this regulation, it could. I would also say that if the divorce settlement agreement did specifically mention who will get the bonds upon Michael's death or otherwise specifically dispose of the bonds, and it is ratified and confirmed in the judgment of divorce, it would be recognized.
Even if Michael, during his life, did not go through the steps that are required in the federal regulations to change the POD?
That is ultimately the estate's position. But again, my whole purpose for standing up now is just to clarify that there is, in fact, a federal regulation that I believe addresses Your Honor's hypothetical.
Because counsel said he thought it had to be in the agreement as opposed to a judgment. You're saying
that's the only point.
Yeah,
Your Honor, that I was trying to make with
you. No, I appreciate it.
I'm sorry. I'm going to ask you again about the governing instrument term in the statute. Mr. Confusione believes that the governing instrument is the savings bonds. When we asked you earlier, I think you wavered between it being the DSA and the savings bond. So what do you believe it is? Because again, the statute itself, Section B, BA states that the governing instrument means a governing instrument. So the phrase is in the definition, executed by the divorced individual before the divorce or annulment. And as Justice Wehner after pointed out, Section 3B:1.1 says that the term government instrument is defined as a deed, will, trust, insurance, annuity policy, or account with designation on pay as pay on debt.
And that's why, Your Honor, I say it is both, because Michael executed a divorce settlement agreement before the divorce, and he also purchased bonds and executed a pay on death designation with regard to those bonds. So we need to look at both of them.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Interesting argument. We'll take the matter under advisement.